Our first reading is from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 10, verses 32 to 45. They were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. He took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Then they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, they will spit upon him, and flog him, and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise again." James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What is it that you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one of you at your left in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" They replied, "We are able." Then Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right or my left hand is not for me to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." When the 10 heard this, they began to be angry with James and John. So Jesus called them and said to them, "You know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize it as the rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not so with you. But whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." This is the word of the Lord. So we began today on the road to Jerusalem. Jesus is in the lead, and he walks with determination. It is likely he, the Son of Man, is the only one who knows where his path will end. The disciples follow behind, and though they've been given two previous glimpses into how this journey will end, they follow not knowing where they are headed. Their faith is still new, and it's being formed. Today's story is also framed by two stories about blindness: the blind healing of the blind man at Bethsaida, and then the healing of blind Bartimaeus, which comes next week. These stories center on the meaning of sight as being able to physically see each other and therefore understand each other, and the more symbolic level of blindness referring to how do I really see you and how do I really understand you? Am I listening? As they journey around the countryside, the framing then shifts the conversation from a public one to a more intimate one with Jesus' closest followers. Here, Jesus is trying to address the question, what does it mean to be a disciple of Christ? So as we encounter Jesus on the road for the third time, foretelling his death and resurrection, we hear these words that Jesus will be mocked, spit upon, flogged, killed, and then after 3 days, he will rise. After this information, it seems as though there should be a dramatic pause for all of us and the disciples to digest this information. If you're following along in your pew Bibles today, in fact, our Bibles have put in such a kind of pause with a subtitle. They're all over the Bible, subtitles that break our reading into sections. But without that pause, that the editors put in, just hear those words of James and John. They just cut in. "We want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. We want you to do for us." They're talking to Jesus here. It's as if when Jesus is talking, they're not really listening, instead formulating what they want to say. I know I've done this before. I bet you have too. Someone wise is speaking and we're not really listening. We just want to be the first to speak out. Perhaps James and John have been thinking about this question for a while. Some chapters back, Peter asked Jesus, "Who is the greatest?" So then from that conversation, I could see them journeying through the countryside. Some of the disciples are in the back talking low. "So I'm the greatest, right? No, it's me. Who do you think Jesus likes the best? When he gets to Jerusalem, who do you think he's going to put into power? Do you think I'll get the corner office? Maybe the ambassadorship? I don't know." I mean, if they're following the standards of the world, the one who speaks up first often gets the prize. Or perhaps their question is more like a childlike dare. "You go up to the teacher." "No, no, you do it. I'll give you a quarter if you ask the question first." So in a bit of an ironic twist on a couple weeks ago's story about Jesus welcoming the least of us, by illustrating this by holding a child in his arms, the disciples try to manipulate Jesus in sort of a childlike way. But like any well-versed parent or teacher, or someone who's trying to be a well-versed parent or teacher and have some boundaries, Jesus asks a furthering question. "What is it that you want me to do for you?" And the disciples respond, "Give us the best seats in the house, one on the right and one on the left." Here, James and John are singled out for being rather obtuse, but really all 12 disciples are implicated here. The other disciples are mad because they didn't speak up first. So Jesus throws in the punchline. "Whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Being a disciple is about taking on an entirely countercultural way of life. And thinking about that question, what does it mean to be a disciple of Christ? I've been inspired in the last couple weeks over this book I've been reading by Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. I'm sure many of you have already read it or are planning to. It might win the National Book Award as a finalist. And Coates himself is the one of the 2015 recipients of the MacArthur Genius Award. Some have called it the most important book of the year, if not perhaps the decade. It had its book launched at Union Baptist Church in Baltimore. And Coates told the New York Times that the book came out of, and it was written for, an African-American readership. It's a book about Black identity, experience, and outrage. And so it's a book not written for the predominant culture, yet magazines as diverse as Elle and the Christian Century have said that this book must have a wide readership. Elle says, "This is not some multicultural kumbaya edition. It has all the hard truths and sharp edges. Coates forces white people, those he calls people who believe themselves to be white, or dreamers, to face the brutal reality of Black oppression in America's past and present." The book is written as a letter from Coates to his adolescent son, focusing on the experience of being a Black man in the United States. He writes as a son, a husband, and a father. He writes about being a parent to his son. He says, "Black people love their children with a kind of obsession. You are all we have, and you come to us endangered." He writes about how this world is an entirely different place depending on where you come from and to whom you are born. He remembers his own childhood growing up in Baltimore. "To be Black in the Baltimore of my youth was to be naked before the elements of the world because of all the guns, fists, knives, crack, rape, and disease. The nakedness is not an error nor pathology. The nakedness is the correct and intended result of policy, the predictable upshot of people forced for centuries to live under fear. The law did not protect us. And now, in your time, the law has become an excuse for stopping and frisking you, which is to say, for furthering the assault on your body. But a society that protects some people through the safety net of schools, government-backed home loans, and ancestral wealth, but can only protect you with the club of criminal justice, has either failed at enforcing its good intentions or has succeeded at something much darker. However you call it, the result was our infirmity before the criminal forces of the world. It does not matter if the agent of those forces is white or black. What matters is our condition. What matters is the system that makes your body breakable." End quote. I've never lived being afraid of for my own safety, for my body, for my family's safety, for my son's safety. It's a given, it's a privilege that I have. So I would be those who among Coates calls people who believe themselves to be white. For me, it's a little bit ironic because I'm actually half Chinese, but it's about how race for me is how people perceive you to be and the privileges that they give you without that perception. For example, I've never been followed around a store because someone thought that I might steal the goods. With my child who's learning to ride his trike, we take over the entire sidewalk, like it's our God-given right to have all of the space as ours. When I'm occasionally pulled over by a police person, which I occasionally am, I'm often let go. I'm often let go with a warning. I've never been asked to step out of my car. I've never been afraid of my personal safety. Or perhaps your experience is more like that of Coates, or the experience being stopped by the police that Brian Stevenson writes in his book that we are studying as a congregation, Just Mercy. Perhaps each time you are stopped, or your child or loved one is stopped, you fear that a minor violation might end with brutality, or even worse. We know the name of Sandra Bland, the woman who was pulled over on a minor traffic violation and then days later died in police custody. Or of the 15-year-old who was shot on his porch in Syracuse a couple of days ago. He was just sitting on his porch. Or the man who was arrested near Georgetown this week as he opened the door for a white woman with a stroller to be gentlemanly. She called the police on him out of fear, and they arrested him. The challenge of being a Christian living in this country at this time is to not look away. For many of us, it would be easier to do so. For those of us not in fear of losing our bodies or our children's bodies, for those who actually pretty much feel comfortable with our way of life, the challenge is to confront the distance between black and white, the distance between those who have privileges and those who do not, the disparity between rich and poor that has grown so wide in our country that it hasn't been this wide since the 1920s. To become disciples together, I hope as a church we feel safe in this space to take a pause. It's a pause that the disciples failed to take, a pause that prevented them from listening, a pause that we take on our journey as we seek to become disciples of Jesus. For the disciples, their faith was new and it was being formed. Even if you've been a Christian since birth, all of our faiths are also still new and being formed. It is time, even if we've done this before a million times before, it is still time to pause for education, a pause for discussion, a pause to listen deeply to where God is calling each of us this day. Without the pause, you remember, the disciples ended up sounding quite foolish. I'm worried that without the pause, we also end up sounding quite foolish. The pause is to listen to those voices who are not the loudest, those voices who are at the bottom of the tree, those voices whose positions don't bring power, the voices that are long silenced. And this is our pause, stepping into Jesus' countercultural message of discipleship. It's a message that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. A message that whoever humbles him or herself shall be exalted. That the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. It's the message of the cross, the message of God taking on the violence and all of the suffering of the world, a message of God weeping on behalf of those who suffer, a message of God who suffers alongside and with those who have the greatest pain. And it is not about a God who condones suffering, but sees suffering as an outrage. So continue to be outraged too. Or if you haven't considered being outraged, be outraged this day. And then in the safety of this church community, in the safety of God's grace for all of us, of non-judgmental listening and hearing and being together, pause to take in all of those voices and listen to where those God voices are calling each of us into Christ-filled prophetic action. This is the word of the Lord.